Good morning. I hope you had a good Christmas, a new year. We had a good time. You know, while we were singing this morning, I had this great idea. It's a bit unconventional, but I think what we need is the praise team to stay up here, right? So, you know, a bit like Saturday Night Live, and you get to a certain point in the sermon, you have this, you know, point you want to make, and the band goes da-dum or something, you know, David and Bathsheba. So Nathan comes to David and says, "You are the man, da-dum," and it just sort of kind of emphasizes the message. I don't know if it'll work, but anyway. So guys, do you want to? No, okay. We'll give it a miss this morning. You know, preparing a message is a little bit like preparing a meal. You put a lot of effort into it. All these ingredients together, and you put it in a certain order, and you spend time, and finally the message is put together, and you lay it out on the table. But it's up to you and me if we're going to sit down and eat it and take it. So this morning, this meal has been prepared for you, going to be placed in front of you. You have a choice whether you're just going to sit there and look at it, or whether you're going to grab your knife and fork, or maybe just your fork if you're American, and dig into it. I encourage you to partake of the meal that's been prepared for us this morning. So what are you looking to change in your life as this new year unfolds? Perhaps, I think maybe for many of us, the first thing is, well, we need to lose some weight. Maybe clear a debt. Perhaps you want to change your job. How about get a certain qualification? Or simply avoid becoming too busy and overloaded. I'm sure we all have things that we want to change. But you know, there is a much more important question that we should answer. And that is, what does God want to change in my life this year? I recently had a dream, and actually I know it's a dream, because in Joel 2:28 it says, "Your old men shall dream dreams and your young men shall see visions." So I had this dream, and it was quite strange, but a few of us were standing in the back of this room over by the door there, and someone who I don't remember approached one of the members of Faith Alliance, and I do remember who that person is, but I'm not going to say their name. And really, though, it could have been any of us that this person approached. And they asked a question, and they said, "Do you cherish your faith?" I wonder how you would reply. Don't answer now, but do you cherish your faith? Anyway, this person had a somewhat puzzled look on their face, and they couldn't reply. And it seemed to me in that dream that they didn't really understand the question, do you cherish your faith? And so I approached this person as I felt I could illuminate the question a little bit more. And I said, "You know, it's a bit like some people cherish their cars while others just use them for transport. So how would you know if someone really cherished their vehicle? Well, they'd ensure that their vehicle was always spotless. They'd lavish their attention on tiny details. They're always looking for ways to make it better, to improve it. They read about it. They talk about it. They attend meetings about it. They daydream about it. They'll even tell you in excruciating detail about the passion that they have, even if you don't share their interest. They often spend vast sums of money to add to what they already have, maybe taking something off that was perfectly good and putting a chromed one on instead. They protect it. They defend it. They know if it's received the slightest dent or scratch, for such people. It is more than their most valuable possession. It's their life. And as I shared my insight to this person who was asked, "Do you cherish your faith?" they started to cry. It seemed from sadness, of course, and a longing, because they didn't understand what that meant. And then the dream ended. Do you cherish your faith today, or has it become little more than a means to get to heaven? Okay, let's get back to reality. So the real answer to this question is probably not going to be found in the words of our reply. If someone asked you, you might say something that is, quote, the right answer. But the real answer, I think, will be found in what we actually do day to day. What we do when no one else is watching. Or maybe what we do when somebody is watching. I think one indicator of how we cherish our faith is how we worship, especially when the pressure is on. When you or I get squeezed, what oozes out of us? You know, for many in the Bible, worship was provoked through anguish, through hardship, through adversity. And I just wanted to list a few people that I'm sure you'll remember. Think of Joseph. He refused to compromise his faith, although it would have been easy, and dishonor God. Think of Job. He went through all those experiences of suffering, but at the end of it, he said, "I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now, after all this has happened, my eye sees you." He went from 2D to 3D through that experience of pain that he went through. Daniel, he refused to compromise his faith. He continued to pray day after day. Think of David, the psalms that he wrote, the things that he went through, the times that he was pursued by Saul, and yet he clung on to God. Think of Mary being told that she was going to become pregnant, unmarried, and yet she said, "My soul rejoices in my God." Paul, the list just goes on and on. Just consider these scriptures that paint an amazing picture of worship. 2 Corinthians 12:2 says, "I know a man," this is Paul speaking, "I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago, whether in the body I do not know or out of the body I do not know, God knows, such a man was caught up to the third heaven." Have you ever been caught up in worship where you'd be hard-pressed to know exactly where you were? When someone asks you what you do, is your first thought, "I am a worshiper of the living God"? Now, it may not be the first thing that you say, maybe it is, but is that the first thing you think? "I am a worshiper of the living God." Jesus said in John 4:23, "But an hour is coming, and now is, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For such people the Father seeks to be his worshippers." In other words, a Christian's job description is worshipper. That's who the Father is looking for. He's not looking for workers, servants. He's looking for worshippers. Have you ever experienced worship when you're aware that the Spirit of God was the one in control? In the next verse, John 4:24, Jesus went on to say, "God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth." Do you ever desire God to fill your soul as much as you would long for water if you hadn't had any for days? David said in Psalm 42:1, "As the deer pants for the water brooks, so my soul pants for you, O God." Have you ever worshipped with such exuberance that you could be accused of being undignified? 2 Samuel 6:16, Then it happened, as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, that Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw David, King David, leaping and dancing before the Lord. And she despised him in her heart. Have you ever worshipped in such a way that others accused you of being drunk? As the Spirit fell at Pentecost, Luke records in Acts 2, 12 and 13, and they all, that is the onlookers, continued in amazement and great perplexity, saying to one another, "What does this mean?" But others were mocking and saying, "They're full of sweet wine." Have you ever worshipped in such a way where you were totally consumed by the Lord? Nothing else mattered. No emails coming in or texts coming in or projects that you had to do or something that, nothing else. You were just totally consumed with God. Psalm 86:12 says, "I will give thanks to you, O Lord my God, with all of my heart, and I will glorify your name forever." Do you ever get to the end of a time of worship and wish that it could just continue? Psalm 34:1 says, "I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth." You know, I'm sure there's room for all of us to experience more. But is there a longing in your heart to do that? To experience more of God this morning? You know, it's easy to let other things, sometimes even good things, crowd out that which is the most important. You know, there have been occasions when Anne has sent me upstairs to get something, maybe like a pair of material fabric scissors or something like that. And she says, "Well, while you're going, can I take up some boxes and can I bring the laundry down when I come back down?" So, you know, moments later, I dutifully return with the washing and she says, "Where's the scissors?" See, I was too much that I had to retain. Give me one task. Don't ask me to do three other things because only one of them's going to happen. If the scissors are the most important, let's get that job done first, shall we? So let's look at a series of events in Acts that puts all this into perspective. And we're going to pick up the story in verse 14 of chapter 16. So Acts chapter 16, if you have a Bible, we're going to be referring to some verses and I'm just going to give some summaries of others. But Acts chapter 16, we're going to start in verse 14. So here, Paul and some of the other disciples were preaching in Europe and they win their first converts. A woman named Lydia and her household come to Christ and get baptized. Wow, what an encouragement to those disciples. These are the first converts in Europe. What a confirmation of God's powerful presence with them. What a validation of the leading of the Spirit. Paul earlier on says, you know, "I was going to go here, but the Spirit hindered, prevented me," said, "go here." And they saw this amazing outpouring of the grace of God. How wonderful. They were in the right place, doing the right thing at the right time. God richly blessed them. They even had free advertising. You know, I think you guys call it a sandwich board. People, they have these boards and they walk around, or, you know, Big Lots sale is on, something like that. Well, they had this here. This lady was crying out in verse 17. "These men are bondservants of the Most High God who are proclaiming to you the way of salvation." Wow, isn't it wonderful to have people around just telling others what you're about? But Paul, knowing that this woman had a spirit of divination, does not want the work of God to be associated with her. He therefore casts out this demonic spirit in the name of Jesus. Yet another demonstration of the power and the presence of God. Another opportunity to rejoice. Well, hang on a minute. Things suddenly change. This woman, a slave girl, was a fortune teller and a source of income for her masters. And when those masters realized that their profit was gone, they became angry. And thus began a sequence of events that neither Paul nor his companion Silas would have chosen. Has it ever happened in your life? End up on a series of events that you wouldn't have chosen. You find yourself in a place that you don't want to be. Things were going well. God was blessing. Things were good. But now, out of your control, you're somewhere where you don't want to be. You ever see the hand of God working in you through some amazing thing towards others, perhaps? And then it's followed by some struggle or opposition. Perhaps you're in the middle right now of a hard place. Maybe that was the thing that you said, I want to change, when I asked you first, what do you want to change in your life? Well, let's see what happened in Acts chapter 16. Firstly, in verse 19, the masters of this slave girl dragged Paul and Silas into the marketplace in front of the officials, probably a bit like policemen. Now, there was no polite, would you mind dropping by the police station at some point when it's convenient for you to answer a few questions? Well, okay, we'll try and do that. No, nothing like that. They were manhandled into the market in front of the authorities. Now remember, they're in a foreign land and in unpredictable times. This isn't a safe place to be doing the wrong thing. Next, the situation escalates as the authorities then take them to the chief magistrates. Now, each Roman colony was appointed two of these officials who were responsible for maintaining civil order. Due to these inflated accusations from the slave girl's masters, civil order was about to break down. So, Paul and Silas are now standing before the two most important authorities in the city and are being accused of throwing the city into confusion. Great. Verse 22, as the accusations start to flow, so the crowd now rises up in anger against these two Christians. What a terrifying experience. Would the magistrates let them be torn apart by the crowd? Would the crowd beat them? Would the crowd stone them? Could this be the day? Could this be the day that they follow their Lord in their death and martyrdom? At that moment, they have no idea what is about to unfold. At that moment, even that looked quite possible. Now, these magistrates were attended by men who carried bundles of sticks. And they're bound together. And these sticks were a symbol and an instrument to enact corporal punishment. The attendants were ordered to beat Paul and Silas. They haven't been able to defend themselves, but now they're being ordered to be beaten. However, before the punishment is administered, Paul and Silas were forcefully stripped of their clothing. Now, this would be bad enough in a closed room, but they were in a public place, in a market, with an angry crowd looking on. Just imagine their humiliation, their embarrassment, their vulnerability. I couldn't imagine what I would be feeling myself at that point. And now they are beaten. Beaten, it says, with many blows. Later in the story, that we see that they were not just bruised, but they were cut and bleeding. Imagine as those blows were hitting them, Paul and Silas were just waiting for that last blow so that they could leave and grab their clothes and rejoin their companions. Luke, the physician, was clearly there. He surely would be able to bring some relief to their pain. But it's not over. The magistrates are not satisfied with the punishment already inflicted and order them to be thrown into prison. The text indicates that that was done with no regard to their current physical condition. The jailer threw them into the inner prison and proceeded to fasten their feet in stocks. No mention was made that their clothing was returned to them. So there they are now, half naked, beaten, bleeding, and locked in stocks. I also presume that nobody bought them any food or drink, and certainly no relief was provided for their wounds. Maybe they'd had some breakfast, but by now, maybe they'd had nothing to drink, nothing to eat for the rest of that day, and it's evening time. As they sat on this damp, filthy floor in the dark, they had no idea what was going to happen next. What further punishment was being planned by the magistrates? How long would they be there? Would it be days, weeks, months, years? Did their friends flee in fear of their lives? Were they abandoned? Where was God in all of this now? Can you imagine how you might be feeling if this happened to you? Just picture yourself on a missions trip. Okay, maybe say to Colombia, place that's not necessarily very safe. At the beginning of the week, you see a number of people converted. A few days later, God demonstrates his power, casting out a demon. Things are going really well. But that afternoon, your world is turned upside down. You're expecting to be going back on the bus the end of the week. You're dragged before the authorities, accused without an opportunity to defend yourself. You're forcefully stripped, you're beaten until you bleed, you're thrown into a prison, and you're locked in stocks. And you're just on a mission trip for 2 weeks. We often think that we're having a bad day. This was a bad day. Back to the story, verse 25. But about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns of praise to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. They were praying. They were singing hymns of praise. So what were they praying? Lord, please get us out of here. Lord, rescue us. No. They were declaring the greatness of God, the saving power of Jesus, the redemption offered through no other name. Their prayers and hymns were declaring the gospel message. They were asking God to rescue others, not themselves. And God answered in a powerful way. Verse 26, and suddenly there came a great earthquake so that the foundations of the prison house were shaken. And immediately all the doors were opened and everyone's chains were unfastened. God sent an earthquake, not to set Paul and Silas free, but to set the jailer free. Verse 27. When the jailer awoke and saw the prison doors open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself, supposing that the prisoners had escaped. But Paul cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Do not harm yourself. We are all here." And he called for lights and rushed in. And trembling with fear, he fell down before Paul and Silas. And after he brought them out, he said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" And Paul and Silas spoke the word of the Lord to this jailer and to his household. And all of them found salvation and were baptized. These two saints, they could have walked away, but instead they stayed and witnessed to the one who had thrown them into prison roughly and locked their feet in stocks. Verse 33, and he, that is the jailer, took them that very hour of the night and washed their wounds. And immediately he was baptized, he and all his household. And he brought them into his house and he set food before them and he rejoiced greatly, having believed in God with his whole household. How dramatically God changed the heart of that jailer from callous and cold to compassionate and kind. And had Paul and Silas fled, that jailer would have killed himself and his household would not have been saved. There will be people in heaven, people in eternity, because Paul and Silas stayed in the middle of that situation instead of running away. Has God put you in a place that you have not chosen? Are you trying to get out of something that God has got you into? Are you asking God, listen to this, are you asking God to change your circumstances rather than change the people that you now know because of those circumstances? Yes, we probably all want to be used by God to bring others to Him, but we want it to be comfortable. We want it to be convenient. We want it to be uncostly. Basically, I want it on my terms. Were you called while a slave? Paul asks the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 7:21. Don't worry about it. If you're able to become free, rather do that. In other words, don't be concerned even if you're a slave. Sure, if the opportunity presents itself to become free, then take it. But don't be consumed looking for a way out. Paul had learned the secret of contentment. Philippians 4:11 and following says this, "Not that I speak from want," this is Paul speaking, "for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am." You know, honestly, this morning, I don't think I can say that to you from my own heart. I have not learned to be content. I was sharing with Randy before the service how there's things that I want to pursue, get done, finish. I find it hard to be content when my plans are broken. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. Verse 13, I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. And this is the secret of contentment, to know, to really know the one who strengthens us. What a privilege it is for those who know Him to be indwelt by the Spirit of the living God, to be able to know His peace and His joy that the world can never know in any situation, to be a worshiper, not just in formality or in name, but in spirit and in truth. So let me ask that opening question again. What do you want to change this year? Or perhaps I should ask what I said was the better question. What does God want to change in you? What does God want to change in me? Does He want you to be content right where you are? Does He want to cultivate in you a greater sense of worship? Does He want to shine through you in the middle of that hard place? See, maybe I'm asking Him to rescue me when I should be asking Him to rescue the one next to me. What freedom awaits those who have learnt to be content, as Paul put it, in any and every circumstance. And listen to this. For such followers cannot be imprisoned. They cannot be enslaved, and they cannot be overwhelmed. Earlier in